and accelerated technologies that have helped accelerate that. But at the same time, let's think about crystal ball, and let's look at what we can learn from the past and what we're learning from the current future right now, and why where we are today and where we're going. And that's a big part about what this talk is about today, and something that I get very passionate about, and that's about livestock, genetics, and people, and improving and feeding the world. So genetic selection has been going on for thousands and thousands of years, and I find it really intriguing when I've done some different talks and I get into groups that aren't animal husbandry, raising animals, doing genetics, all this fun stuff. You start studying history. This mural is off of a tomb in Egypt, and when I first saw it, I thought somebody had doctored the picture. If you notice the picture of these horned cows milking, this was about cheese production back in ancient Egypt about 4,000 years ago. What I find really interesting is the Egyptians, bulls and gods and horns were on almost all livestock at that time, yet this picture shows a cow without horns. And it really intriguing. I thought somebody had doctored the picture, so I did some digging it some more, and there are other hieroglyphics and in bronzes and stuff and actual metals of these females that didn't have horns. So just intriguing. So animal husbandry and things that have gone on for a long, long time. What's been incredible, if we think about the last 50 years, that's my lifetime. I'm just slightly older than that. What's happened in genetic selection in livestock? And so many of the people in this room in this organization have been such a key to that and what's happened in the beef cattle industry. It's just been fascinating. Trying to put some numbers. We take a bad rap in beef about improvement, genetic improvement a lot of times, efficiency and all that. So years ago, I was giving a talk for the Academy of Sciences, and I'm working on a white paper deal back in the early 2000s, pulling from the USDA great set of statistics and things. I've put together some numbers that start giving you a continuum. Genetic improvements having an impact. We can't take 100% credit for these changes, but we can take some of it. And you look at the difference. This is pounds of beef produced per female population in the U.S. So it's kind of a total billions of pounds of beef divided by the total millions of females that exist. And really, when you start thinking about efficiency and where we're getting better, we're not there by any mean. But when you look at 2007, with 26.3 billion pounds produced with 42 million females versus 23.1 billion in 75, and 58 million. So about 16 million more females. So the efficiencies and the things that have gone on from management and genetic selection, we continue to improve. Dairy industry, and we're going to talk a lot about synergies and things that we see happening in dairy and what's happened with some of these technologies today. But the dairy industry is even a more incredible story. 1940s, 25 million lactating dairy cows in the U.S. produced an average of 4,500 pounds for a 305 mature equivalent lactation. This number was taken in 2008 and is probably 2,000 to 3,000 greater than that if I pulled the most current. About 9.2, 9.3 million dairy cows, and that's where we are today, 22,000 pounds per lactation. We have almost a third as many cows, way under half, making way, way more milk, and it's pretty incredible. So when you think of environmental footprint, you think of all these things going on, the impact and genetic selection has been a massive, massive part of that. I like to think about, and this is my lifetime, and when I think about my years in the cattle industry as a young kid raising Herefords, going clear back to the mid and late 70s, all started. But this continuum and timeline, it's fun to sit down sometime and write out your parts of your life is these events have come into the beef industry and the dairy industries and livestock in general. But as we go through, you know, visual appraisal, this is a toolbox continuum. The toolbox never really, it changes and we add to the toolbox, but we never really replace a tool in the toolbox. The toolbox just gets better and better and it keeps building. And so when we think of visual appraisal, pedigree information, the breed associations and verifying pedigrees historically, performance data. Those of you, and we're all older that are old enough, the total performance record-keeping programs with in-herd ratios began back in the 70s. I remember sitting looking at our in-herd ratios and getting all excited on certain ways certain animals were ratioing in their calf crop. In the 80s, with computers getting big enough that we could start doing genetic evaluation and our first genetic merit, our expected progeny differences values hit in about the mid-80s in the beef industry. Roller coaster ride, not a lot of data up and down, but it was still a better tool than we had before. And every time we've made a tweak to this tool and we've added to it, it is still a better tool than we had 5 years ago to work with. And that is really an important message as we struggle and bulls re-rank and things happen. But it's still better information and we have more predictability and we can move forward and make better decisions and move genetic gain at a more accelerated rate. Economic indexes are the backbone of how we need to select cattle. And then those are going to continue to improve at the rate at which we go. As we think about what happened with simple genetic recessive DNA tests and how that allowed us to capture and utilize genetics better when we have a known defect, but we can breed and work around these things and still capture those valuable genetics in that population where that defect might be segregating. Small genetic panels that started and stuff, and that was a real learning experience and how much information do they really contribute. But we had to go through that, cutting our teeth to getting to high-density panels and adding this genomic information and giving us some more information with more prediction. And I was very fortunate in part of my life to get to be in on the base floor. That's genomic and NCDs. I have in green things of the future, and we like to talk a lot about things of the future. And as scientists, we talk about how far we can take the future and that usually dial that back about 50% then once we get the technology and actually try it. But it makes things move and things move forward and move forward at a fast rate. There's this intersection that's gone on, though, here in the last 10 years of this toolbox that has these genomic enhanced genetic merit values now. And over the last 30-some years, our advanced reproductive toolbox continues to get bigger and grow. And this is the toolbox that we use at Transova and what it looks like. But artificial insemination, embryo transfer, in vitro fertilization, sorted semen. Of course, uteruses are still the backbone of having enough of these when we're making lots of embryos. Genetic resources, unique things that we can maybe take to the commercial industry, like sexed embryos for commercial replacements in dairy and beef. Cloning technology. Cloning has an interesting place. As an animal breeder, cloning slows down genetic gain. But there's unique instances where we can capture value in animals that we're not going to be able to contribute due to injury or death or untimely by utilizing cloning. And we do quite a bit of bovine cloning in the U.S. at Transova. And then Allison's going to talk to you about some cool things with the future if we get allowed to do it with regulatory in the U.S. But precision breeding or gene editing. I think of it like the seed industry, top dressing these unique genetic lines that we're working with and we're continually making them better and better and being able to come in and make a few little tweaks in the DNA for some unique things to just kind of add that little extra that's needed to make an animal particularly a little bit better and just top it off. So why have we used ART historically? And ART historically gets used at the top end of the pyramid. But I will say that the greatest improvement in technology that hit the beef and dairy industries was artificial insemination. And it really captured and has allowed us to create the genetic merit programs and really start sorting these things out and make genetic improvement. And everything else after that is as a result of artificial insemination. But being able to take the very elite parents, and with advanced reproductive technologies like IVF, we can capture that side of the female, and she can have a lot more than 6, 7, 8 calves in her lifetime. She might be capable of having 100 of them. So now she can leave genetics like a bull site would, or a bull that's getting used fairly heavily. That contribution, that ability to get those daughters and sons that are better than their parents is much more increased. And we've seen this continuum, ET, and I talk about this personal timeline. We made our first pregnancies with our partners in Iowa for in vivo embryo transfer. Those calves were born in fall of 1981. We paid $2,500. $2,500 for a pregnant recipient. Pregnant recipients right now, I think the May price is like $2,490. And so that as technology gets better and things do get cheaper on something that costs extremely expensive. But fun to think of how that fits in and what we've been able to do from a genetic improvement standpoint. I'm a geneticist. I have to put this up here. We have to look at this. But this is the backbone of what we do. When you're selecting animals and trying to do genetic gain, this is what we're the equation that when you're in a master's genetics program, animal breeding, you learn about this equation, and you're going to probably be asked about it on your defense or your written, however it is. But genetic gain, the accuracy. Accuracy is what's changed in young animals, but accuracy is how predictable is that genetic merit information that we're utilizing in those from those parents. Genetic variation is what we have to work with in the population, and that's a good thing. Having variation in a population of genetics for many traits and stuff is extremely good because it allows us to get to certain specs. It allows us to get to certain targets. It allows us to move. Without genetic variation, we can't make genetic gain. Intensity are the parents that get to be the next generation. Is it the top 5%, 1%, 10%? And the fewer those are that are at the highest level, the faster that gain is. But the big one, and the one that kills us with cattle, is generation interval. It's a long time from the time we put semen in a cow or embryo in a cow till that animal actually starts producing its own progeny and we can capture value or a gamete that we can sell for value, either a fertilized egg or semen. It is a long, long time. And so it's not a game that speed will get you there very quick. You have to be extremely patient. And when you make mistakes, and you don't make mistakes because there's a lot of unpredictable things in genetics, but it takes a while to realize them a lot of times before they've been made. And we'll talk a lot here in the next few minutes about generation interval and how can we change generation interval. So I talked about this harnessing the power of the cow, and this is the getting both sides of the equation in genetics. We all know that we get a chromosome from our mom, a chromosome from our dad, that comes together and makes us. It's harnessing that female side of the equation with that elite bull side, and in vivo flushing and in vitro fertilization has been a way that we've done that. Transova has been in this in vitro business since 1992. I had my first IVF calves born in Dunlap, Iowa in 1993, in the infancy days of that technology. That technology has now become mainstream just over the last decade, and it is really, really giving a lot of options for producers in their genetic programs, and the dairy industry has just really taken hold and done this. For those of you not familiar with IVF, just real quickly, because you'll see a lot of the trends and things that have happened with genetics and dairy. This has been has been a big part of driving that, along with a couple other technologies. We actually harvest eggs from the ovary, just like we do in humans. It's a biopsy, a needle aspiration that's done. Those eggs are unfertilized oocytes. They're harvested. They're fertilized in the lab, and this gives us a lot of options. We can use sex semen. We can take conventional semen and sort it for which X and Y, or frozen sex semen, conventional ferts. You have these abilities to move eggs around, move embryos around with incubators, and do this. One of the cool things, and you see in this cartoon I showed in this previous slide, that's a pregnant cow. So now we can get donors pregnant, and from about day 40 to day 110, 120, as long as we can reach those ovaries, we can make embryos out of her while she's pregnant, which has changed the management of our elite donors and been able to keep them more in a 365-day calving, which is extremely important. Long-term elite females that you're making lots and lots of progeny out of. There's this intersection that's happened with these technologies, with genomic enhanced genetic merit values and with ART and IVF. And this is some numbers from Transova that I pulled to show that intersecting. But if you go back to 2007, we're doing about 4,500 of these ovum pickups in these cows a year, procedures per cow. In 17, we're over 40,000, and we'll eclipse right at about 60,000 ovum pickups this year in beef and dairy in North America alone at Transova. That same time, the improvement in embryos, and that's what you'll see in the upper quadrant right there of the slide, the number of viable embryos that are being produced per ovum pickup, the red bars equal the in vivo flushes across Transova, which is about at the national average, somewhere between 5.8 and 6 point some embryos per in vivo flush in beef and dairy. And what you got to remember is there's a huge amount of these young dairy heifers, and yet that ability, that technology improving. And in beef cattle, we average well over 7 embryos viable embryos for ovum pickup, and in dairy young heartifers, we average between five and six. So technology's improving and other technologies colliding. And the reason I talk about that is because this is what's happened in dairy. And I think we all need to, I like to look at other species and look back historically about how things have evolved in different parts of management and selection and trends and patterns and the way that happens. And I was fortunate when I was with Pfizer Animal Genetics to get to be the beef geneticist that had to play the dairy geneticist while he was at Pfizer, when we brought the commercial dairy genomic product to market. But in the dairy industry, I call it the race. And it's become, how fast can we turn these generations? How young can we get semen out of these bulls and these heifers and make the next generation? And it's a fascinating thing. When I went to meet at Dr. Faber at Transova, and I was looking at what I was going to do with the next part of my life, with travel and everything, and looking at opportunities in the industry. And there's this intersection of genomics and ART and what was happening in dairy. And that was in 2011, this changing interval. And this is how it works. I mentioned earlier I was part of a wonderful consortium, and Dr. Jerry Taylor was part of that, and Kurt Van Tassel, Tad Sonstegar, Latchmead, Bob Snobble, Steve Moore at Alberta, but the University of Missouri, handful of us at Clay Center, USDA Beltsville, and Alberta got together, which was interesting for all of us to get together in the industry, pooled resources, and started working on building the first high-density bovine chip. And I use pictures of the old chip because it's a little near and dear to my heart. Actually, it was 12 years ago, Jerry, this August, that we had our first chips, and that just in our labs, and that just fries my mind that it's 12 years. But you start looking at the impacts of a technology. This in dairy has worked incredibly well. And I'll show you what it's done to the industry and how it's changed it. But these young females and bulls are born, and they immediately have a tissue sample taken. Genotypes are generated at some level of density. Most of it is greater than 10,000. A lot of it is 60,000. But high-density chips on all these animals go to the Council for Cattle Dairy Breeding, the CDCB. Genomic-enhanced genetic merit values come back. What's incredible about that information, like in Holstein, is that young heifer, the day that you have that information back on her, for her milk, her predicted PTA, which is an EPD in dairy, is like having 30 to 40 daughters in milk production with a 305 mature equivalent calculated. That's just extremely powerful when you think about the data and what it is. Part of the reason that they've been able to jump on this and use it. These young dairy females, we start as young as 6 and 7 months of age making pregnancies out of them in vitro fertilization programs, and I'll show you at the end here we're pushing that envelope even greater. These heifers are aspirated. A lot of them are conventionally fertilized because we need both males and females for our nucleus populations in the companies that we work with, and we gestate embryos. And it's a game about as many hits as possible, because a little thing called Mendelian sampling, no matter how high the parents are, our distributions, and we'll talk a little more of that also. But this is what's happened. This is the clarified Zoetis product, and this is a commercial herd that was done. If we look at parent average and sort that herd on their genomic information and then look at their milk production, actual milk production for a 305-day milk lactation, the PA is the parent average. From the best 10% to the bottom 10%, we've got about a 2,200-pound difference in that 305 equivalent. That's a lot. So genetics work. We can sort on pedigrees. We can sort with utilizing that information. We can do quite a bit of prediction, and it looks pretty good. Now, you have things with sire groups and different things that are going to sort those groups, and you really can't understand what Mendelian sampling happened. What's the difference in the full sibs, the half sibs, who's the best milker or the worst milker that's coming out of those groups? But when we put the genomic enhanced genetic information to it, and the commercial industry was able to leverage what the elite end of the pyramid had been building in dairy all those years, 7,000 pounds in that same herd when we sort them on genomic enhanced PTA information. And this is on net merit, so that would be an overall production lifetime index. And we look at those actual milk productions. So this phenotypic information, it actually really, really works and really works well. And you, and what you've seen happen is, this is in April, I pulled from the CDCB the number of genotypes that had been done in Holstein alone since 2009. It's 3.1 million. That's primarily North American genotypes. What's incredible is to see, you can see the first predictions in 2009 with a lot of the animals that were used for the initial predictions and training in that. But it was about in 14 they really started getting some commercial uptake after we launched. We launched it in 2012, the clarified product in the commercial dairy. Those are months, and you look at the years. And some of those months are hitting 50 and 60,000 females a month. Annually right now, there's somewhere between probably 400 and 500,000 commercial dairy females being commercially genotyped with genomic information and decisions being made in sorts and who's going to be the mothers that are going to get sex semen to raise heifers, or commercial females going into IVF programs and making their elite replacements themselves with the genetics they have. So why does this work so well in dairy, and what are the things that are similar and what is different? Data. The data is unbelievable. When you think about it, the progeny testing that has been done in the dairy industry for years has been done on a large scale in large commercial dairies, and with DHI recording, and I talked about this female goes into, she starts lactating. It's a repeated measure every month: milk, protein, fat, somatic cell count. That data in the amount and the quality of it is unbelievable. That's driven this huge difference when you look at these accuracies. Large amounts of unbiased data. Dairymen record everything. And when you start looking into health and all these things, the amount of detail and the amount of data that they're able to work with is incredible. Huge, huge part, massive connectivity, North America and abroad, but greater than 95% of the dairy cows in the U.S. are bred artificially inseminated and, you know, very little natural service. So we are getting lots and lots of progeny information and connectivity across herds and that are contributing to these genetic evaluations. So this is what changed and really changed the structure of the dairy industry. Parent averages, like we talked about, and traditionally in that works. But this, I keep mentioning Mendelian sampling and the segregation of chromosomes and pieces of chromosomes, little thing called recombination that mixes stuff up in your gametes so you're not inheriting whole chromosomes necessarily from your parents. Full sibs are not the same. And we have a thing of, we talk about, well, I'm going to buy this bull because he's a full sib to the high seller last year and that. And that's great. He might be genetically superior, but he might not. We get a distribution. If we can make 1,000 matings between this bull and this cow, and we look at all the progeny for just weaning weight, we're going to get a genetic distribution that is normally distributed. And a lot of them are going to fall around the parent average. But we're going to have these tails and differences. And I put a picture of my brother and I from a number of years ago out in National Western. We're full sibs. Ancestry's been done. We know we're full sibs. You can see the difference. And I'm the one that didn't get the extra height and the nice skinny weight distribution. So genetics keep mixing itself up. And that's what changes things. And that's what's changed the dairy industry. Now we got this tool and we can sort this out. These full sibs suddenly have value. And I'll give you an example. It blew my mind the first time I got a call from a genetic company, elite dairy calf being born at our facilities. Set of full sibs, 5 bull calves. They called and said, hey, just don't get your team wound up, but we just insured this one for $250,000. This calf is 30 days old. And all 4 of his brothers did not hit the bar where they needed to be and were castrated and sent to be fed. And so that's this restructuring. And when I hit Transova and that change that was going on in the industry, it totally restructured it. And over the last 10 years, this is the dairy genetics industry 10 years ago. And the majority of the bulls being produced were contracted from Holstein and Jersey producers. And the genetics companies buy those contracts, buy those bulls, lease those bulls, and all the semen then goes to the commercial industry. They have the bulls, and the bulls are getting used by the breeders and creating those next generations. This is the Holstein and Jersey industries, the genetics industry, dairy today. We've had a massive consolidation going on in the genetics companies. Every one of these genetics companies now has big nucleus populations, and the number of contracts annually gets smaller and smaller and smaller from the elite genetic producers. And in many cases, the elite genetic producers that used to sell bulls to five different companies, the really, really top ones have been locked up and are not locked up, have been given offers and dollars to just work with one company or another. And so this whole change in the structure of how that those businesses operate, they still sell semen the same way, but these outcomes, it's changed this industry. It's changed the structure. It's changed how it's done. Extreme differentiation in young animals because of the accuracy of these predictions. Consolidation of genetics with the development of these big nucleus populations and very controlled and planned proprietary genetics. Some of the companies are putting end user agreements in place that if you produce an animal that's high, they have a decision of what happens with that bull, animal, cow, or in most cases it's sex semen, a female. But if you produce a bull, they have first option, and if they decide not to, it's very limited to what you can do with that animal. The privatization genetic evaluation systems, that's happening everywhere, but most of the companies are working with unique traits and making sure that they have the ability to do genetic evaluation now. So are we seeing vertical integration like pork and poultry? We are seeing some huge operations from conception to consumption with the consumer, with their own products and product lines. And I think that's a reality that all of us need to understand and where we all fit in the community in that. This has been greatly accelerated by these technologies. So where's the beef when we look at this? Where is beef falling when we think about all this? How far have we gotten? We've gotten quite a long ways. And when we think about the differences in the structure and what we have. The top part of this slide is that our genetic evaluation system that has been in place since sometime in the mid-80s and has worked really, really well. We've made a lot of improvement. It's incredible to me sometimes that we don't rely on this more the way we use it, but we're seeing more and more when you sit down and when I talk to different commercial cattlemen, people I'm helping with breeding programs and that. It used to be that they would talk about phenotypes. They would talk about just utilizing a producer. Now they'll sit down and they'll want to talk about an index. They'll want to talk about what they're trying to do. And it's not a one-size-fits-all when we do genetic selection. And understanding the goals and what clients are trying to do is so hugely important. Our ability to harness genomic-enhanced information in our genetic evaluation system is great. It's not as powerful as the dairy industry, but it's moving in those right kind of directions and being able to do that. And having that ability to understand improving accuracy and knowing more in a young animal is quite incredible. I pulled this from American Angus's website, progeny equivalence. So when we talk about accuracy and we get all, you know, accuracy, what accuracy? It's an expected progeny difference, this genetic merit value. It's an estimated prediction of that animal's genetic merit. And we never really truly know its true genetic merit value until we get thousands of progeny with phenotypic records that actually drive us closer and closer to its true genetic merit value. If that's a plus 0.3 for birth weight or a plus 2.5 for birth weight, and we have thousands and thousands of progeny and we have an accuracy of 0.95, it's going to do a pretty, pretty good job of getting that right and predicting that. What we have, when you think of our progeny equivalents and where genomic enhanced information gets us with the growth traits, I can go out and buy a yearling bull with genomic enhanced EPDs and feel fairly confident that an accuracy somewhere between 0.35 and 0.4 for birth weight, maybe a little higher in that range, it's going to give me a progeny equivalents of about 21 calves with birth weight records turned in. I'm pretty confident if I'm buying bulls and I'm looking at a bull that I want to use calving ease, and I'm looking at his calving ease and his birth weight, the numbers that I'm honing in on, that where his number is falling relative to his parent average, and with that accuracy, that he's probably going to be somewhere in that zone. The possible change, though, with only 21 progeny equivalents with an accuracy of 0.35 to 0.45, they can still move. They go up, down. Pound either way And I'd have to look. There's actually been through the years, have calculated those possible changes for those different values and accuracy. But I feel pretty good that I'm in a range, at least, that with some confidence. Well, we don't do very well as in the traits that are the backbone of our industry. When we look at our carcass traits and we start looking at progeny equivalence and boost in accuracy, we're not where they are with milk production, fat, protein. Our accuracies need to get higher. And before we really cut loose and lots of young beef females and start driving generation interval back and we in the young bulls and females, and we do it with the young bulls. The industry has done that for years. We use a young bull extremely heavy, and then if he progeny proves himself, keeps getting used or not. If we're going to use young animals and use young bulls, we need to use populations of them. Knowing that if I use 10 bulls, I'm going to have a couple of them that are going to fall out of where their yearling EPDs and their indexes are. And I'm going to have two or three of them excel, and the rest of them are going to hit right around where the numbers are. But we have to think about that mentality of how we use these young animals with the information we have. But if I'm buying a bull, if I'm recommending a young bull, he's got to have a genomic enhanced EPD in order to get maximum information and take advantage of everything that's there in the toolbox to minimize and mitigate risk. So the beef industry, as we think of the structure of it, and I'm not a crystal ball. I wish I could. I could probably retire and make a living doing something else if I could really crystal ball this really, really well. But the beef industry is structured different than the dairy industry. This is the upper end of the beef industry that produces all the bulls that we sell to the commercial industry. That's what that blue arrow is. These are the animals that ultimately, in a generation away, produce the beef that gets consumed by the consumer for all the different programs. We sell and contract bulls to the genetic companies, but not 100% across the board. We have a lot of breeders and a lot of groups that do that. It's not just the 4, 5, 6 big genetic companies with their beef programs that in driving that. So it's an interesting dynamic in how that's structured and how that's different. But where I challenge everybody is we have got to get to collecting more real carcass data, more data, mature weights in cows. These kind of things that we've got to, with the quality of the data and that. We can talk about technology, we can implement technologies, but we have to continually work on the foundation of those technologies. So generation interval in younger animals, and I've alluded to that. We likely will, and we're starting to work with some programs ourselves and within Transova and with our clients. We're taking a portion of those elite young females and doing some female matings for the next generation and accelerating that. However, it's not at a point where I feel like in dairy, a young genetic dairy donor that starts IVF at 7 months of age, when we breed her, if we have 40 or 50 pregnancies by the time we breed her at 13 months, 12 months, 12, 13 months of age when we get her pregnant. We'll make a few more embryos and pregnancies for ourselves and our clients, but once she hits 40 or 50 pregnancies gestating, she gets to go off to a commercial dairy and create phenotypic data. She might have been the 10th highest female in the world, and she likely, by the time she calves, she'll never be a donor again. And that is how fast that industry is turning those generations. And you look at the improvements that they're making and at the rate at which they go, but it's a fast, fast pace in the great race, as I like to refer to it as. Impact of these technologies in the commercial sectors, and that's where I get really excited, because I think ART is at a point right now where we're sitting those crossroads and we can start doing some really fun things with cost and with commercial heifer replacements in these programs and getting it utilizing that F1 maternal cow by utilizing these technologies to make that and being able then to take a three-way cross with the right terminal sires that hit your branded specs or whatever the specifications and the groups you work with to hit those margins and take advantage of the heterosis and things that we know works over and over. It's been proven. It's incredible when you start looking at the dairy industry that has been very fixed on just two breeds. But that F1 female, when the groups that have started making those, it's incredible what that Holstein Jersey cross female does. And she eats 6 pounds less of feed and dry matter a day just on body weight differences alone, that F1 compared to that Holstein. That's so incredible. Impact of technology, commercial identity, and then change and improvement. We always are going to continue to improve. That what happens to the future in that, how it evolves, All of us are in a position right now, and we always talk, through the years and in my whole life, everybody talks about change. And we're always at this time in the beef industry with all this change. And it's kind of like a revolving wheel, because you hear that from speakers and different things through the deal. But when you look back, there are those key times of change, but it's always changing, right? It's always evolving. Things are always changing. And if we don't change, improve quality, improve processes, all these things, other people get to dictate what that change is. And so as an industry right now and stuff, and we're fragmented because of how our industry harnesses these low-quality roughage resource that humans can't consume that exists all over this great country. And we have all these different sectors. But as a whole, we've got to start with a mindset and working with everybody that's involved with it from conception all the way to the consumer consumption and working as a team. Or we will kind of be told how we are going to get to fit into these industries as we go forward. So genetic selection of the future, and I'm going to go through these real fast because these are kind of out there, but we're actually using some of them in our nucleus programs. Fetal cell line selection and embryo cell line selection. You're going to hear more and more about utilizing stem cells and utilizing doing genetic selection and stem cell lines and that. We did back in shortly after I came to Transova, we did an experiment, fairly large scale. We make IVF embryos. We would put like 5 embryos into a recipient. We would gestate those for about 22, 23 days, and then we would go in and with a large catheter flush these fetuses out. And we'll get somewhere between 2 and 4 fetuses back. It's a 40 to 55, 60% recovery, which kind of fits in the range of preg rates, so the embryos that didn't make fetuses. Then we take that little fetus and we made a cell line. And so we can grow an embryonic cell line from that fetus. We take then growing up millions of cells over a couple weeks, 3 weeks, and we can freeze those away. We take a jug of that, a little tube of that cell line, and I can extract lots and lots of high-quality DNA from it, just like I got an ear tissue punch from a calf, and send it off for genotyping and get genomic-enhanced genetic values back. We can then look at the cell lines and look for the extremes, and then use cloning and take a cell from another frozen tube and make calves. And those are 5 little bull calves that the day that cell line came through, and it was about 70 cell lines into it, was the second highest Jersey bull for one of the Jersey indexes, overall production indexes, that had never existed. And with cloning, we were able to assure that we could get that. We've taken that one step further where we're now making those cell lines straight away from 7-day embryos, 7-day old embryos. So we don't even have to mess with a 23-day recipient gestation recovery. The key to that is how efficient can we get with the number of embryos. If we make 5 embryos, can we produce like 4 cell lines? And that it's efficiencies about all these kind of things that become the big hang-up. Are we better off making fresh embryos and frozen embryos and just gestating them all, get the genetic, genomic enhanced merit values on the backside, and getting those hits that you need? Because it's that number of animals, getting that Mendelian sampling, hoping to get something beyond that parent average that moves things forward. Another program that we've done, and we're using it commercially with some of our big genetic clients and within our nucleus population and producing quite large numbers, is laparoscopic OPUs in young dairy heifers. These heifers, we collect oocytes on anywhere from 60 to 150 days of age and make embryos and make pregnancies. This bull calf was when the 6 months of R&D when we had started it, but when he was born and we had genetic merit back, information back on him, his mother was 11 months old. She had already produced the generation and was not old enough to be pregnant herself. And so turning generation interval upside down. So as we wind this down, I look, how does beef genetic pyramid change over time? This is what dairy is really starting to look like. The dairy pyramid's always been there. What's happening is we're seeing commercial embryos being used in the commercial, starting to be used in the commercial sector of the dairy industry. Specialized genetic products, big genetic outfit or big commercial outfits making their own from their elite females. Genomics has allowed them to manage the replacement female in excess better, and they're working really hard at getting better at reproduction so they don't have to make so many heifer calves. This piece of dairy beef, this beef animal that was a Holstein steer that the packer has struggled with for years, and some of them saying no more at these locations. Instantly, as the heifer programs and the matings of that happening, they've turned to the beef industry and started breeding those cows to beef. So there's another whole segment of industry that there's very little data on. And some of the people that have the data, of course, it's not that different universities are starting to look at. Beef calves raised in dairy sector with either via semen as a half-blood dairy beef or straight beef calves. Dairymen are looking at having straight beef embryos made and raising straight beef calves in that pipeline. So there's probably upwards somewhere between about 3 million dairy beef cattle killed in the U.S. right now, dairy historically, or dairy beef. With the management of heifers, that's probably going to grow by another 2 to 2.5 million over the next 5 years because of the extreme precision management of these heifer programs and only making the numbers that they need. So what does the beef industry look like? And I'll say that the biggest thing, if you come away today from listening to me talk, and hopefully I haven't gone off on too many tangents in that, is still, number one, is a collection of quality phenotypic data, complete data, good data, contemporary data, all of those pieces. Everything that we have done over the last 30, 40 years as it relates to the toolbox, as it relates to genetic selection, still comes down to those primary things. And this organization, I think the first BIF meeting I went to was in 97, and I saw Dr. Von Vleck in Nebraska 2 days ago. There was a PhD defense of a young lady that has done some really deep, really neat genetics work, and Dr. Von Vleck was there. And we got in a little car and drove all the way up to North Dakota, two of his grad students and myself. And that was my first Beef Improvement Federation meeting. And I would say there were probably maybe 100, 120. And then this meeting has exploded, and for good reasons why. But the backbone of what this meeting has been about, understanding models and understanding phenotypes that we need to collect, and how do we make genetic improvement in beef better, and how do we help the commercial sector, the cattlemen that make our living in the upper end of the pyramid that buy the bulls and the semen from us, how do we help educate? All these pieces that this organization, group of industry, academia, all of it that gets together from so many aspects has been such a wonderful thing. And with that, I'm extremely honored and humbled to be here, and I think we'll have some time after Allison's deal for some possible questions with the schedule, but thank you.